8 years, every Saturday morning on the Moondog Matinee from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on WESU Middletown.
I continue to be much more concerned with the prospect of a nuclear weapon going off in Manhattan.
Mr. President, Bill Hickok's already on it.
Read The Hammer of God, the second in the Wild Bill Hickok trilogy from author Tom Avitabile. Available in ebooks and paperback at Amazon.com and Barnes & Noble. The Hammer of God. It's only fiction till it happens.
And today, it's not fiction. We actually have Tom Avitabile. He's took the time out to phone in from Puerto Rico. Life must be good. We also have Marty Kina in Studio B. And you're listening to WESU and, in particular, Carnivore Radio. Tom, are you there? Ooh, my fault. Tom, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hello.
Well, good.
Welcome back.
It's been a while. And how's the book sales?
Doing great. Got a new book coming out, hopefully shortly. Working on a contract on it right now, and all indications are it's going to be a winner.
Well, that's really good, because I consider you a winner. And one of the things I'd like to talk about, it's the crocodile hunter's anniversary of his death. And I was thinking he would be 57 years old now. He led a life of adventure, of inquiry, and an involvement. And I was thinking, you know, your life, you're an author, you're an advertising executive. I think I saw some YouTube videos. They didn't call you a Renaissance man. There was some other terminology associated with it. But I guess my question to you is, very few people live that kind of life. In other words, a life of adventure, of engagement. Most lives are, what, quiet desperations. What do you think of that, Tom?
Well, first of all, thank you for the promotion. There are a number of people in life who really do go out into the wilderness and bring back either, you know, the cure for cancer or some magical thing, or discover a species. I'm not really that much.
I'm actually
Indiana Jones there. You know.
I'm talking about a life of adventure. I think most people just kind of go through.
Yeah. Play it safe.
Yes, we had another guest that's going to be on in May. And he has this thing, it's called, he's a New Yorker, actually Southern Connecticut. And his whole thing is about going through life, kind of just, you know, going down the stream. It might even be successful, but not basically living a life of engagement or adventure. What do you think of that?
Well, yeah, listen, I think the key is to be open so that when an opportunity presents itself and it's not really with a shining neon sign that says opportunity, that you give it a chance to warm up to that level. There were many things where had I thought about either consequences or tried to think it out or use what information I had at that moment, I probably wouldn't have gone that way. But in the beginning, it's naivete. And as you get older, it turns into an openness. And when you, I guess.
Yeah, but wait a second. I think that's interesting, Tom. As you get older, you said openness. And two things I'd like you to talk about. The openness as you get older, because I think they're diametrically opposed. And also the opportunities that don't present themselves as bright, shiny, neon objects. Talk about those.
Yeah, well, I think everybody has these kinds of stories in their life. Whether they recount them or they put them in their bag of assets or not is really the difference of whether or not they repeat these things. But there's you know, it's often you're going in one direction and all of a sudden something pulls you to the right and that changes everything. And there's a million decisions like that every day. There's a million decisions that if you would have taken two more steps, you would have been in the path of the careening cab. If you didn't see the red light and that car zoomed by you, you would have been there. You know, there's all these millions of decisions we make every day. And it's only in as a Monday morning quarterback can you look back and say that moment right there when I decided to do that, that's what changed my life.
Well, actually, let me interject with another thing about that time that's kind of interesting. I saw a movie with Jimmy Stewart. I don't know the name of the movie. And it was an amazing thing. He said something like, most of the time, your decisions that you think are of low consequence or low turn out to be the biggest that you ever did, like not going left at the red light or going to meet someone at a bar. Talk about that. I think that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, well, because what you're talking about there is, like I said, these things can only really be appreciated or given value in hindsight because you don't know how it's going to play out. And you know, the magical, wonderful thing about our lives and our memories is we get to edit our own highlight reel. So let's say out of 99 times that we made a left where we shouldn't have, the one time we made a left and it worked out, that's the one we remember, right?
Mm-hmm.
The question is, what do you do with that information? If you own it, if you bring it into yourself and you say, wait a minute, here's something that happened because I went against my own grain, or I didn't prejudge something, I didn't use prejudice, I didn't use another experience to shadow this experience, but I was open to it. If you take that as a lesson, you're going to get more of those, because by mathematical definition, you're going to allow yourself into more opportunities to cross or come across veiled or obvious opportunities. But if you shut down and you don't, if you just think it's random, if you think you're just walking through life, if you think that it has something to do with fate or God or luck and not the fact that fate, God, and luck have chosen you to be in that situation, then you're not going to repeat it.
How about the whole thing you talk about, you know, in terms of people, you know, as they get older, you talk about, you know, being naive at, you know, maybe when you're young, we all do that, and sometimes that works out for the best. But as you get older, many people are not receptive to opportunities or that, you know, maybe even a little glow of light, because either they've been beat up too much or they become so conservative. And sometimes, here's my little theory, I think when you're, whatever, 85 years old and you're on your deathbed, so to speak, you're going to realize, like, wow, why didn't I have more adventure? Do you think any validity to that?
I have to tell you something. Your timing is perfect on this. I am down here in Puerto Rico to celebrate an 89-year-old birthday, and everyone in that clique is of, between late 80s and early 90s. And I'm down here right now with these people who are more vibrant, more alive, or have more energy than you would ever imagine in what maybe 50 years ago we thought a 50-year-old should have. I mean, these people are amazing. And a guy just said something to me on the beach, a retired New York City detective, pointed at one of our guys, and he's a very rich, very wealthy man, and somebody had a problem, and he just handed them $50,000 to take care of their little life problems, said, "You get a chance to pay me back." That's a nice story, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then the cop said, That's why he's 90 years old and he's still in great shape, because he gives, because he's not stingy. He doesn't hold it in. And I think it's the same idea. The same idea is, if you're open, if you're giving, if you accept, and it doesn't mean you have to agree. It doesn't mean that you have to change your values or anything like that. It's just, I guess, a realization of, we don't know everything. And every time we think we know something, something in the universe, whether it's God or fate or just the happenstance, kind of shoves it in our face and says, no, you see, you didn't know that. So it gives you a humility. And that humility in the face of all things, humility in the face of randomness, humility in the face of all the things that have to do with humanity and people and people's predilections, I mean, that's a key component. So if you can hold on to that, if you can hold on to being open, if you can hold on to humility, if you can hold on to gratitude, and I think you wind up on a beach in Puerto Rico at 90 years old with nothing but love and friends and fun around you at all times. And all the hard parts of life are still there. but you have these moments that are just fantastic. And I think mostly it's the gratitude, the humility, and being open. I'm living in it right now. I mean, it's just so perfect that you're
brilliant. And what keeps you going in terms of, you know, you have all the opportunities to kind of play it safe. I mean, you didn't have to, you know, even start on your journey in terms of becoming an author. You were a successful advertising executive, and now you're coming out with another book. We'll talk about that in a second. But, you know, what keeps you, the fire in you, going?
Well, I don't know. You know, this is hard for me to talk about because I'm not really crazy about patting myself on the back, and it sounds like you are. But I would say that the key is and this could be a problem, so I'm not advocating this to anybody, but I'm the kind of guy, and I realize this, who I battle all my way down to the 10-yard line. And I'm on the 10-yard line, and I look, and the goalpost is only 10 yards away. I mean, the touchdown is 10 yards away, and I get bored. I say, move it. Move it to another 50. So, you know, it's too easy now. And then I battle my way another 40 yards. I get down to the 10. It's the same problem. So I keep pushing the goal line. I keep pushing the goal line because I get bored. Mm-hmm. I keep pushing the goal line because it's now too easy. And there's just something about easy that doesn't comport with the way I think. So if something is really easy, I'm out of it. I'm bored, you know?
That's interesting.
And we had
a motivational guy on the show, very good, and he was talking about when things become easy, that's sometimes a danger zone, maybe career-wise, life-wise, mm-hmm. spiritually-wise. So that's kind of interesting that you bring that up.
Well, you know, in my past, I have gotten ahead in a lot of different businesses by walking, and I've literally done this. I've walked into an established business that had been around for 30 years, was doing it the way they do it, and on my first day on the job, I realized they were doing it wrong. Well, that's a real ballsy kind of position, right? To say
totally, yes.
You guys doing this
wrong. I could actually get you a nice pink slip, by the way.
Yeah, on the first day.
Yes, exactly.
So instead, I went into the studio where they were mixing Pumping Iron with Arnold Schwarzenegger, mm-hmm. and I went to the studio and I borrowed a piece of equipment. And rather than telling them that they were doing it wrong, I showed them a better way to do it.
That's much.
And when the boss came in, I said, "Let me show you." And I showed him, and now remember, first day on the job. And I showed him a way to do what they were now doing in 5 hours in 33 minutes. And he looked at me and he said, "Son, I'm going to make you a mixer." And what that meant in those days was a film sound mixer was something that took at least 20 years of apprenticeship to get to. And I was made a mixer on my second day because I saved the boss $4,500 a show times 33 shows.
Very nice. Well, let's see what if Studio B has a question for you. Marty, any you've been observing the conversation.
Well,
I'm
enjoying
it.
Hold
on, any thoughts or any reflections on that?
Absolutely. My reflection and is on this 90-year-old gentleman who I was doing the math here that as his success was growing, he was starting probably in his 20s back in the 1950s. And so as he was building his career, you know, it was almost like a golden age of American economy. You know, he really had an opportunity to grow his business or whatever it was when America was really America. And I'm wondering, Tom, if you see an opportunity in today's world that would make it more difficult for a gentleman that you're talking about, whereas in the past, society was a little bit more open itself, whereas today we're a little bit more divided and may not be as open to itself, you know, providing opportunities like this gentleman had back in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah. Well, you know, at every point, innovation is hard. At every point, entrepreneurship is hard. At every point in history, all of the forces aligned against you, whether they're natural, synthetic, competitive, governmental, or just societal, are always going to be pointed at the person who tries to be different, the person who tries to stand out, the person who says, "Hey, you know, I want to try this." And I think, you know, the failure rate of most, you know, businesses is a testimony to that. Unfortunately, in many cases, the failure rate of marriages is also a testament to that. But that's a whole other story. The idea of trying to do something different, of seeing an opportunity in a marketplace, seeing an opportunity in society, and trying to actually do something about it. There is, you know, you get into the Newtonian laws of physics. You know, objects in motion tend to remain in motion, and objects at rest tend to remain at rest unless acted upon by another force. So you, if you look at everything in the world at any given point, whether it's the 50s, today, tomorrow, or 25 years from now, there's going to be a status quo. There's going to be objects at rest, and there are going to be objects in motion, and they're going to resist any change in that. You come onto the scene as a new force. So the question is, can you outforce the objects in motion, and can you propel the objects at rest? You're always going to have that resistance. Now, what it has changed is, in my mind, the miniaturization, the computerization, the AI is putting us towards a threshold that we've never been at before. And I speak about this. If you've read any of my blogs, I've really become an anti-technologist. The argument used to be, when the steam shovel came out, you know, why use a steam shovel when you could use 50 men with shovels? You know, why are you putting 50 men out of business with one steam shovel? And you could be on either side of that argument, and whatever happens, happens. But today, the steam shovel is the computer. And the steam shovel back then, no matter how hard it worked, could never make another steam shovel. Computers today can make other computers. In fact, the whole incestuous idea of the digital world is that it requires less and less to do more and more. So where a steam shovel was a threat to manual labor, the computer is a threat to everything because it can simply replicate itself. It can replicate itself in all areas. AI is, you know, depending on who you talk to, never going to happen, or it happened last week. I just have an article in my blog about a mechanical arm that in Columbia University that they tried an experiment with AI. They just turned it on, didn't tell it what it was, didn't tell it what its job was, and had no sense of what it was. And in 33 hours, it figured out what it was and what it had to do. It became self-aware in 33 hours.
Do you know what's interesting, Tom? I read a book when I was going for my MBA, and it was called A Brave New Workforce, or Brave New Workplace. And one of the theses, the overall overarching thesis of the book was that technology, as you kind of alluded to, interferes, takes over, intercedes at the lowest level. Like, in other words, they talked at that time that it might automate the mailroom, and then it moves up. And basically, the premise of the book, as you're articulating, is absolutely correct. It starts off, and people are so willing to accept it because, oh, it's only the mail clerk, it's only this. And now, it's at, you know, as you're saying, it's at higher and higher levels, and now at the highest level, correct?
Well, it's definitely getting there. I mean, the people who thought their jobs were automation-proof are finding out that's different.
Oh, yeah, no, okay? Even
we're
jobs.
We're talking about lawyers. We're talking about CPAs. We're talking about executives and companies. They're suddenly, they're on the same, short plank as the guy in the mailroom or the factory worker in Detroit, because it's coming for everybody. You know, when it was a simple repetitive task, like this arm has proven to us.
Oh, no, that's what the whole premise of that book was. It's exactly it, that it's, you know, at the lowest level, it all seems fine. And like you're talking about higher level occupations, like I think CPAs, you know, anyone would tell you an amazing degree to get. It's like bulletproof. It's age proof. It's amazing. But that, and like another friend I have is an architect. Two jobs that can easily be taken over by computer technology, easily. And one of the things about things like architecture and accounting, what's really dangerous about it is that because of places like India, which is a 12-hour time differential, it can be processed at night and delivered in the morning. So it's even lower cost and also working while other people here are not. So,
yeah,
100%. Very dangerous.
And now, if I could intercede, Tom, just real quick, you know, even if you take it to the next level as far as militarization of this technology, and I'm sure that there's a lot of programs out there looking how AI can improve, quote unquote, our military. You know, go back to the 70s and you saw that movie War Games, and you know, the Whopper was going to take over the codes for nuclear launch. You know, you could see how that could be a problem, and even go back to the Cuban Missile Crisis, where there was thank God for the Russian submarine captain who decided not to launch because he was getting erroneous information. So, I mean, if we put all of our eggs in that basket, who knows what kind of calamity could occur?
Well, yeah, and this has been the theme of Failsafe and Strangelove, and you know, the human response to this was to put it up against the worst technology we had, which was the atomic bomb, and say and try to show the evils of automation with the atomic bomb as the doomsday device. But the doomsday to a worker is when they get a pink slip because they've been replaced by AI. And to your point, when it was the mailroom, nobody cared. But I want to go back one step. You know, when I talked to you about the arm in 33 hours became self-aware? 800,000 years before man started to use tools, the primates were using tools. The primates were using rocks and sticks to do things. It took 800,000 years for whatever our ancestors were, in terms of whether they were Neanderthals or not, to pick up on what the primates were doing with tools. This machine did it in 33 hours, okay? So if you look at a human or even a Neanderthalic development curve in terms of cognizance and in terms of ability to use tools, which we've all been taught is a higher order thing, if you remember, you know, the 2001 when he throws the thing up in the air and it comes down, that this happened in 33 hours in New York City at Columbia University.
Well, yes.
That a machine became self-aware, and there are still people out there saying that, no, it's never going to happen, and it's already happened.
No, it's definitely already happening, but also you bring up another point that it took so many years for us to replicate the development of primates. Okay, got that. But isn't there a bigger issue that the development of artificial intelligence is so exponential – and we're linear. Isn't it very logical playing it out that we'll all be replaced by AI eventually? Because the human brain can't keep. It's already surpassed already. I mean, isn't that kind of obvious?
Well, I think there's two issues here. One, to a certain degree, science fiction has created a clarion call to this, but it's also obfuscated the issue, okay? Because you go too deep into this and everybody thinks you're talking science fiction. My book's a science faction, okay? What I write science faction. My first book was about artificial intelligence. My first book was about artificial intelligence becoming sentient and you know, horrible times ensue. The question that this comes down to, and I'm very often yawned at when I bring this up at my meetings, because I go to these meetings now and I say, just because we can, should we? Just because we can do this, should we?
Yeah, but that's a good moral question, but doesn't it really boil down to economic viability, that it's destined to happen because economically it makes sense? It's not even a moral issue.
Didn't slavery make sense economically?
And that time it
and
did.
Isn't a machine a new slave? And who's served by putting 10 million drivers out of work with autonomous driving vehicles?
But then we're in a global economy. I'm not saying I agree with it because I could very well be replaced. I would be on the receiving end. Okay.
Well, that's my point. My point is, what, just because we can, should we?
Yeah, who's but the point. Look at this. But we're in a global economy. If we don't, China's gonna, right?
No, not necessarily so. Because here's the thing. Nobody's looking at the end game, okay? If you tell me, this is great technology because we're going to have drones delivering boxes, okay? Mm-hmm. So we're going to eliminate delivery men. We're going to eliminate that.
You're going to eliminate whole, truck drivers, okay? Everything, yes.
Yeah, right. So then you say, okay, who owns the drone? Well, today, you know, Jeff Bezos owns the drone.
Yes.
Okay? So isn't he like the evil guy now, Dr. Evil? I mean, if he owns the drone and he's put, you know, every drone puts 10 people out of work, is he not the evil guy? And what happens to those 10 people? They're not going to be trained to be drone pilots. They're not going to be trained.
No, they're, but they'll be part of the permanent unemployed class, which will become a reality for America eventually. You got people that will be permanently displaced. If you're a truck driver and that's what you do and you can't be trained to be a eye doctor, you're going to be permanently displaced, aren't you?
Yeah, so here's the thing. At what cost? If you listen to the geniuses in Silicon Valley, they say, well, the government will recompense. The government will pay people. The government will pay people to sit on the sidelines once their job has been replaced. And that's just so third grade.
That is, so, that, do you know what that is? That's called rationalization. Right. They know it's not going to happen. It's just a go-to alternative that's never has any viability.
Let's roll back then. Let's roll back to a bunch of humans, and let's look at what makes a human a human. And let's look at what makes a machine, and talk about the differences, because a human being has an element that a machine at this point does not have, which is called dignity. A human being has a sense of worth and value based on what that human being does. And you take a person and you pull them out of a fruitful career, whether they're driving trucks or working in a mailroom, suddenly they have no handles. What happens to that person?
Oh, oftentimes, wait a second, Tom. I was doing this show and Marty was doing this show and others that, you know, in 08, people were basically thinking they would never work again. And the human cost of that, I had this on the show. People were actually, not many, thank God, were contemplating suicide. I mean, people fall apart.
Exactly. So here's the thing. What are we doing? I mean, who gives a flying whatever that we can have an autonomous truck?
But the ruling class, Tom, the people, the oligarchs, like your Jeff Bezos, do they really care? They're worth $300 billion. Do they really care if Tom Avitabile or Jeff Sherman or Marty Keener are gone? What do they care? Coming to that? They're the modern-day rubber barons.
100%. You see, and that's what I'm saying. History repeats. Everybody thinks we're sophisticated now. Everybody thinks it's different now. It's the same story. It's back to the steam shovels. Only the only difference here is, as I said, steam shovel could never make another steam shovel.
It would.
A computer
yes.
can easily make another computer. So the question is, who's speaking for humanity? Who's speaking for humans? Who at the table?
If you want my dire prediction of that, Tom, number one, have a good point. It's not even as it being able to replicate itself. That's another issue. It's a relevant issue, but to me, it's the ascendancy into higher and higher levels of our society. Meaning, you know, you got the mailroom, truck drivers, and now you're talking about teachers, lawyers, and the whole shooting match. I think, and you can comment, and I'll throw it out to Studio B for a second, is that, yeah, people will wake up, but it's the cat would already be out of the bag. And for the 1 or 5%, like your Jeff Bezos, they'll be doing fine. Everyone else, good luck, because where are the jobs?
Who is everyone else? Who is everyone else? Who is this technology serving if half the population,
the masters,
or more than half
the masters of the universe.
Yeah, exactly. So what you just described is the fomenting point of all revolution. Okay? It's the disparity that creates the revolution. It was true in 1917, it was true in 1776. So what we're doing here with technology is we're stirring the pot for revolution. And there's no reason to do this.
Okay, I love your point. I love your point. Here's my last point before I throw it out to Studio B. All the revolutions were man versus man, power versus a certain other element, right? Now, but what happens now when you have man essentially versus machine, a non-emotional, non-thinking in terms of emotionally, just talking about just the facts, just the economics of it. They're totally rational. Listen, truck drivers, I love you to death, but it's just cheaper to have a drone or a self-automated truck. So other revolutions were government against the people. Now it's people against machines. Isn't that a whole other ball of wax?
You know where the term saboteur comes from?
Yes, a French word for throwing a boot in a machine.
Actually, yeah, close. It was the sabot, which was in Holland, and they would clog, which is why they also call the shoes clogs. They would clog the machinery with their shoes.
Yep.
Because the machinery threatened their livelihoods. That spirit, that human spirit, is not going to go away by government grant or fiat. And the question is, before this thing gets more uncontrollable than it is, who's speaking for humans? Who's speaking for the human element? Because every time you talk about this, as you pointed out, it's always, well, that's just the mailroom guys. That's just these guys. That's just those guys. That's just, and as the same old story used to say, when they came for the gypsy, I said nothing. When they came for the Jews, I said nothing. You know, it's the same thing. When they come for you, suddenly it's an issue. We're all on that line. And servicing who, to whose benefit?
I think the
technology thinks that they're going to be the recipient.
Okay, but
they don't see themselves as the victim.
I got you, because it's at lower and it hasn't come for you yet, just as you said.
There you go.
But
100%.
The recipients of the benefit are the masters of the universe, Silicon Valley, in this particular situation. They're prospering. They're doing quite well, frankly, eventually at the expense of all of us.
Amen.
Studio B.
We can change this. We can change this. We can pull the plug on it anytime we want.
We have another question for you.
Together as human beings, we still have the power until we don't.
Okay. You're listening to WESU 88.1 FM in Middletown, in Carnivore Radio in particular. We have a conversation with Tom Avitabile, a leading author and thinker. So, Studio B, Mr. Keena, do you have a question or a thought on what we've been talking about?
Here, and I appreciate the opportunity here, but you know, we talked about technology being compartmentalized into kind of an oligarchy, perhaps, you know, in terms of the larger mainframe, yes, but technology now is open to everybody. And as we're seeing, particularly in the political world, the technology that's being manipulated is manipulating society at a whole different level other than just jobs and producing and manufacturing. It's really changing people's perceptions towards dealing with one another, challenging traditional values, actually stirring up things that we thought perhaps had disappeared in our society, fostering hate. So there's a whole level here where maybe machines are a threat, but I think we're also a threat to each other using technology. Tom?
I listen, you're 100% right. That is applied technology, which is humans still doing it. In other words, all of the social media issues, depending on which side you are on them, they're all, even, you know, Twitter, they're all first implemented by a human. So it's humans utilizing the technology for the amplification. One person on Twitter, one person on Facebook can kill a product, can kill a television show.
Right.
I mean, and 57,000, you know, bots online can look like a million people against a product, against a service, against this, against that. We've seen incredible examples of that where we've given too much credence to clicks. We've given too much credence to likes. We've given too much credence to these impersonal, anonymous forces that have been allowed to kind of fester on the internet.
So going back to Jeffrey's point, you know, maybe our higher level thinking skills need to be a little bit more in tune so that we can be a little bit critical and be better critical thinkers, and rather than being just so accepting of things that are being provided to us, you know, perhaps being a little bit more suspicious. And
I'm all for that. I'm all for critical thinking, and I think that there's nothing that afflicts this world right now that critical thinking couldn't help solve, as opposed to the party lines, as opposed to this is how we do it, as opposed to there's nothing we can do about it. And again, I bang into this all the time when I talk about technology, and I just say, listen, it's not destiny, it's a choice.
Right, and then you've got these
destiny yet.
You've got these machines like Siri. I don't know exactly how they are represented in the commercial world, whether they're assistants, home assistants, or whatever. But now that they're picking up conversations and particularly around the holidays. I recall hearing that all of a sudden things were being delivered to the house because they heard the kids asking for a dollhouse or a bike, or they just assumed that it was about to be ordered, and they went ahead and ordered it anyway. And so now you have to be careful about what you even talk about in a private situation with these machines.
Well, actually, Tom,
and again, you elect to bring that machine into your house. That's the point. Okay.
Yep.
The AI, the challenge with AI is it doesn't need a human.
Right.
All right. We're talking about AI not needing a human.
Yeah,
we're
How about the point of we all have smartphones now? I assume you do as well. And this kind of, call me naive, but very, very, to me, it kind of freaked me out. I was teaching one of my college classes, and we were talking about privacy. And then we went on to talk about Heinz 57 ketchup. And guess what? I had like many students, can't tell you the percentage, say, hey, check this out. They had pop-up ads about Heinz 50 because we were talking about it. That to me is kind of creepy.
Let me put on my other hat now, guys. I'm an advertising executive. Okay?
Yep.
Gmail. Wonderful thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because it's free. Why is it free? Because everything you put in Gmail is scraped, okay? So you write your friend that you're thinking about a boat, and I can buy that. I, as an advertiser, I can go in and I can bid on that, and I can buy you, and I can serve up an ad to you or a pre-roll, or I can put a tracking cookie on you and see exactly where you go about boats. And I'll get a lot of competitive data. I'll get a lot of marketing data of someone, which we call someone being down the funnel, okay? People give this up rather than paying you the $12.95 or whatever it is for a non-scrapable email service. Same thing with the Alexas, same things with smartphones. We give all this up. There's 57 pages if you agree to our terms and nobody ever reads it, you know, and they just hit yes. Well, then somewhere in that terms is we have the right to read everything you do and sell that information, and they say, quote-unquote, anonymously, but that means anonymous is we don't know your name, but we know your Social Security number.
Yeah.
You said that anonymous?
Yeah, I mean, doesn't that make 1984 look like a joke? I mean, if, let's say, government has access right now, let's say 80% of people have smartphones, they know everything you've done, they know all your conversations. I mean, you could get to the point, if you had an authoritarian government, they could lock you up for treason because you were conversing with someone else about how much you hate the new leader.
They're doing that now in Turkey and other places.
It's not government, Jeff. Government can't get into these things. We're talking
for
about,
now.
We're talking about Google. We're talking about Google.
Well, Google, Google.
If Jeff Bezos runs for president, that could happen.
That's what I'm saying. There's the very, very thin line between Amazon, Google, and the government. I think you'd be shocked at the.
Yeah, listen, I would let you have that one. But the point is, this can't work if we opt out. We still have the choice, okay? This none of this stuff works if we opt out, and we're not opting out because, and this is my line, the devil always comes to you with candy. The devil never comes to you with Listerine and say, here, take a swig. It's always something sweet, okay? iPhones, smartphones are sweet.
Oh, yeah. Okay?
ATMs are sweet. We didn't care about all the tellers we put out of business. We didn't care about all the bank branches that are disappearing because that's sweet.
Because it didn't affect us either. Didn't affect us.
Exactly. Again, back to when they came for them, I didn't give a damn, you know? So the thing is, what's organically happening to the human condition and how technology stands poised on the precipice of not just the next evolutional leap, but a magnitude of order leap of a billion, or maybe even a trillion. And you know, here's a sobering thought. In 1980, I wrote a little pamphlet. Okay. In 1980, I wrote a pamphlet talking about the development of computers. And in 1980, okay, in 1980, or the mid-80s, actually, it had taken 429 years to go from the first practical steam engine to the jet engine. 429 years to go from the first steam engine to the first jet engine. It took 40 years at that point to go from the ENIAC computer to the Cray computer. The Cray computer was the biggest, meanest thing in the world at that time. Today, it's the size of your smartphone. But back then, okay, That would have been, if automobiles had advanced at the same rate as computers up to 1980, in 1980 you would have been able to buy a Rolls-Royce for a dollar, it would get 10 million miles to the gallon, and it would have enough power to drag the Queen Mary over dry land. If cars had escalated in their development at the same pace as computers, and that was 1980, okay, today the smartphone you hold in your hand is would make any cray cry back right. in the 80s.
It was more and powerful forget, than got people the on the moon.
They went to the moon on 16K, man.
Yep.
Not 16 meg, not yep. 16 gigs, 16,000 bytes
right.
took them to the moon. Okay?
Yeah, you mentioned now, the ENIAC computer, right? And that was something that I was going to mention later on, but now that you've mentioned it, I have a little bit of statistic about the size of this thing. It weighed 30 tons. And it
right.
and it included more than 17,000 vacuum tubes. When was this actually constructed? Back in the '50s?
No. It was developed during the war, and it was a run by the Department of the Navy. It was electronic numerator, integrator, and computer.
Right.
It was ENIAC, and it was it's the basis. If you look at my first book, I actually one of the Lady Admirals who's involved in the program is the guy my hero calls back in when there seems to be something wrong with computers again. He brings her in.
Yeah.
So I'm well versed in this. But the ENIAC was the tip of the literally the tip of the iceberg in terms of military applications of computers, which was known for a while as computational warfare. We're in that today, deeper than we'd ever want to be.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, look, the ENIAC, when I came up in the mid-60s, the IBM 360 computer in its 95, the IBM 95 360, took up a whole floor of a skyscraper, man.
Right. And that was using Fortran, right? That was the Fortran language?
Fortran, COBOL, all those.
Right, 1957.
Yes. Now.
Yeah. And then the mid '60s, and that was the second generation of computers. Was the 1401? Third generation was that. And now we're talking about plasma machines. You know, and we're talking about petaflops. And you can't even conceive. I mean, we've done it, so it's measurable, it's calculable, but the human mind can't even conceive of the advancements in power. I mean, just look at YouTube. Look at every video on YouTube. Look at everything that's up on YouTube that's public, and then that even 10 times more that's unlisted on YouTube. That's all stored somewhere.
Yeah.
That's petroflops everywhere.
Before we talk about your book, I want to end on one thing. Is okay, we talk about the economic costs of computerization and AI, AI. But how about the social costs, the emotional costs? I believe, and Billy Bob Thornton said this, believe it or not, I think it was on Larry King. The guy was brilliant. I thought he was a dumbass, but he was actually really smart. He was saying that, all these social media and all this stuff, and it was his infancy back then, has the illusion of making you feel important, but in the end, you've never really been more disconnected or unimportant. And I just see, people's inner, no one really interacts with anyone anymore. You don't sit on the porch and have a beer or a lemonade and talk about the day. I think the quality of life has suffered greatly by technology and all the interpersonalization that we once enjoyed is out the window. What do you think of that, Tom?
I think that half of your audience can't even relate to sitting on a porch and talking. Look, this is what I said about the devil comes to you with candy. Okay. What are we sacrificing here? We're sacrificing interpersonal relationships. What we're sacrificing is the knowing of one another as human beings,
we're sacrificing our human condition, what makes us human. But we're giving it away. You mentioned it minutes ago.
Yes.
We're giving it away for nothing. We're giving it away for selfishness. And because we want to be the latest smartphone, and we're not even kicking and screaming to the grave.
Listen, you know what? I play this game with some kids when I talk to them. And I say, let's say this whole AI becomes a gigantic calamity. Now, let's say there's a small band of heroic figures who go up against literally the machine. And, you know, we're 50 years from now, and there's vast social desolation, and there's just places that are just horrible, and there's only little gated communities where people enjoy technology, and everyone has been cast aside by technology and put on government payrolls. Their lives have been controlled down to being just nothing, right? And they revolt, right? And they take over. They're going to turn around, they're going to look at us, and they're going to talk about their grandparents and say, my grandfather, Tom, he was a cell phone user. He was a smartphone user. And they're going to go, ooh, what a creep, right? Because today's technology could be the, I mean, look, slavery was a technology of the day.
Well, wait a second. You ever read
slave owners today? You know?
I know he was a nut. Well, yes, he was a nut. But the Unabomber, his manifesto was actually correct. And the boiling it down is technology comes as a liberator and eventually transforms and morphs into an enslaver. And he talks about the car. Like in 1905, if you were rich enough to have a car, it's a liberator. You drive around, you go to the circus, blah, blah, blah. You drive in the country. And then, you know, 100 years later, you need a car, at least in Connecticut, or you're screwed. You know, so email was once this great. Oh, you send an email to a couple people, and now it's an enslaver. You work 24/7. I think he was right.
No, you're right. And listen, being in marketing, I can tell you this: millennials aren't buying cars.
Right.
They're becoming sheep. They're molding into the fold. They're molding into Uber, and I don't have to own anything, and I don't want a car, and I don't want to do this. And it's a subtle blip, and the marketers look at it, but I look at it sociologically. I'm saying, what's happening to the car represented independence and freedom when we were growing up. Okay? That doesn't make it right. It doesn't make it that's the way it should be. But something that was the very essence of freedom, freedom meaning self-choice, freedom meaning the ability to be your own person, that iconic symbol has now been shunned by an entire generation who are not seeing it as that way.
I think that's
what's in their brain.
That's a great point. And you know something? We'll have to do that again. In all seriousness, because I think that's, as a marketing person, and myself and someone that was involved in marketing, I think it's brilliant, devious, but brilliant, how a whole generation can be convinced to do exactly what you say. Now, before we go, we have to talk just real quick because we only have a couple minutes. Your new book, tell our listeners what it is, what's it about, and how they get it.
Well, my new book is a bit of a flight of fantasy. It's about super warriors, and for the purposes of the story of the book, it actually goes back to a kind of a myth, and suddenly the Russians and the Americans are out looking for this mythological existence. Because they believe in within that is the essence of super warrior. And we both have super warrior programs. The Russians call it SYNAP. And as recently as last year, Putin spoke brilliantly about, you know, their SYNAP program to create the super warrior. We've been doing it on our side. We did it during World War II. We were feeding Patton was feeding certain of his men amphetamines to keep them marching and going and being super warriors. And that research has never stopped. So I just bring it to a head in my book about the ultimate super warrior and a secret team, which I named SEAL Team Zero, and how they are the most effective fighters because they have not superhuman, but hyperhuman abilities.
And the name of the book?
They're not heroes. The name of the next book is Aquasapien.
Aquasapien. Where can our listeners get it? And when does it come out?
They're all going to have to hold their breath like I'm holding my breath for the contract right now.
Excellent.
Should be showing up any minute, and we'll have wonderful news, hopefully, in a couple of weeks.
Well, Tom Evitabile, thanks so much for being on Carnivore Radio. Marty, this was truly an excellent show.
Absolutely. I really do appreciate you taking time from your vacation and birthday party to give us a shout.
Thanks, Marty. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Have a great day.
Thank you.
Yes, you're listening to WESU Carnivore Radio. The views of Carnivore Radio are not the views of WESU or Wesley University. Marty, I thought that was quite good.
Absolutely. The 40 minutes just flew. So, but one thing I do want to maybe go out on a limb, I think the most positive use of AI right now is probably through NASA. You know, the way that we're exploring interplanetary, and actually we do have some of our satellites that have pretty much, or our rovers have gone out beyond our own solar system at this point. So if we do ever make contact with other kinds of species, they're going to come in contact with our technology and our AI. So the fact that for 14 years, you know, Opportunity was up on Mars and actually was only expected to work for several months, and it was able to morph into a 14-year-old project. So I thought that was pretty cool.
Well, I do think that's great, but I'm still more concerned with what Tom was talking about, because I think we won't have to deal with it, but I think the younger people out there will have to deal with huge displacement due to artificial intelligence. What do you think?
Absolutely. And we're also dealing with the hackers. You know, we talked about warfare, our latest assaults from Iran and China on our banks and our important agencies, and the fact that they believe that they've had access to our nuclear energy. That in itself, you know, these are things that we never hear about, but I'm sure are very much a part of our world.
We have one real quick comment.
Awesome.
Caller. Go ahead.
Caller,
go ahead.
Yeah, great conversation, but I just want to add one little bit, because this is something I don't consider myself a real intelligent person, but I don't think you have to be too intelligent. And what I take away from the old conversation is that he says we have a choice. How effective the choice will be eventually, I don't know. But I think I go to the supermarket and I see they have self-cashing register, and I purposely don't use it.
Right,
but
me too.
We as a people are so adaptable. It's every little thing we want to be a part of. And until we can restrain ourselves.
I love your point. I think it's selfishness, and I agree with your point. We're doing it with self-inflicted death. I love the call, but we do have to go. You are correct, sir.
We'll catch up another time. Great show.
Thank you very much. Thank you for calling. All right, let's do one news item, Mr. Keenan.
Well, I chose this one specifically for you, Jeffrey. It's about the gentleman, and I'm sure you've heard a little bit about it, who was out jogging in Colorado and was attacked by a mountain lion and actually had to save his life by choking the animal to death. So I know you're a big hiker, so I just wanted to bring that to your attention. So if you come in contact with an animal, I want you to be ready.
There you go.
Okay.
How about some buzzwords?
I want to start with something that I actually had a chance to visit this past weekend.
We're going to have to change it from buzzwords to small bites.
The Constitution.
Wait, Mr. Keenan. We'll have to
small, bites.
To small bites.
Small bites. All right. We'll go to small bites because we're carnivore.
There you go.
Right?
Okay, go ahead.
The Constitution. A lot of people think it's under attack. You think it's a viable document?
What's that?
Of the U.S. Constitution.
I was unplugged for a second.
That's okay.
It used to be a great MTV series, Unplugged. But anyway, I think it's a viable document, yes.
Okay. A word you don't hear often out of Washington, compromise. Is that something that still could be achieved?
I think, I'm sorry to say, that it is a fleeting premise. You can just look at, we're not going to get into politics, but yes, the two sides used to, Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan were actually decent friends. Those days are over.
Mm-hmm. Landmines.
No, it's always been a problem.
Yeah, a million plus landmines now between Yemen and Saudi Arabia. And again, that was certainly a cause of Lady Diana's prior to her passing.
Yes, it was.
And it seems to be growing. Glaciers.
Retreating, correct?
Yeah, so it's something that's not growing. Our glaciers are certainly going to have a huge impact around the world, providing fresh water to millions and millions of people, primarily in Asia. Lynchings.
Well,
those are in the news.
Well, I have to say that, it's been a long day. I found him, what he did, or whatever the name of the show was, what he was on.
What, this gentleman, guy who made up the story, yeah.
Reprehensible. I love the police chief from Chicago, very articulate. He was PO'd.
Absolutely.
Was not amused.
Nope.
I'm not amused. Racial tensions are not good. Anti-Semitism is...
Did not help the cause.
...is on the rise. Just general racial tensions are
Anti-Semitism.
On the rise.
Anti-Semitism.
Exactly. And
yep.
I think that, you should get... I think he needs a jail sentence.
Yep.
Not 100 years, but he should get 6 months.
Yeah.
And he did it for greed.
Or be released from his show.
Yeah, goodbye.
Absolutely.
Well, great show, Mr.
Thank you
Kina.
So much, sir.
And
to Tom Avitavoli.
Great show, and we'll be back next week with another. No, we won't. I'll be a little on hiatus for next week. But the following week, we'll be back with another exciting edition of Carnivore Radio. You've been listening to The Carnivores.